Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
The 2026 legislative session gets underway next week, and it's probably too early to say what the defining issue will be. A lot of the familiar issues are still on the table: housing and taxes and legislative power and water. But our panel of experts told us this week all of it is going to be shaped by the one reality lawmakers can't escape. It's an election year. We talked with our own Sean Higgins, Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune, former lawmaker Holly Richardson this week, and they all made the same point. A good share of the rhetoric and a good number of the bills themselves won't just be aimed at constituents, they'll be aimed at voters, and more specifically, at a political base. They say you can already see that strategy in some of the bills being introduced, including by one lawmaker in particular, a man named Trevor Lee. Here's Robert Gerke.
Nobody had really heard of Trevor up until a few years ago when he knocked off longtime Representative Steve Handy in a primary up in Layton. He is a very conservative, very MAGA, very anti-immigrant legislator who has put his foot in his mouth a few times, gotten in some hot water, statements criticizing LGBTQ people, you know, going after immigrants, going after the city, going after Democrats. He's very outspoken. Kind of fits in that new MAGA mold that we've seen emerging at the Utah Capitol more and more. And he's got a slate of bills this session, all of which are pretty provocative.
Yes, Representative Trevor Lee, and I represent District 16 here in the state of Utah.
Got it. So you recently made a post about intending to rename Harvey Milk Boulevard to Charlie Kirk Boulevard. Why are you proposing this?
9th South in Salt Lake City right now is called Harvey Milk Boulevard after the LGBTQ rights leader from the 70s. He wants to rename that as Charlie Kirk Boulevard.
Yeah, that was a really easy one. Because that had already been renamed to someone who has no relevance to Utah whatsoever, it makes it a really easy street just to go and say, hey, this could be one for Charlie Kirk Boulevard.
Okay, and you sort of answered my next question, but...
You know, the argument that you get on the other side is, well, if you want to name a street after Charlie Kirk, pick any street.
Yeah, that was one that was formally changed, and the vast majority of Utahns didn't agree with that name change. This now puts it much more into relevance with what the majority of Utahns would like.
It's kind of like, you know, trolling the libs. It's sticking it to the lefties, especially sticking it to Salt Lake City, which he likes to do. Last year, he sponsored the bill that banned pride flags on government offices. So this is sort of a twofold thing. You know, he argues it's a very simple bill. It's just a renaming a street and people shouldn't get upset about it. But it's more than a street. It's part of the community. I was talking to some business owners along 9th South, and over 140 business owners, property owners, residents up and down 9th South have signed a petition saying, don't do this. It's overwhelming opposition to it. But that's what Trevor likes.
Yeah, I'm not convinced it is quite the own he thinks it might be, because I feel like if you actually wanted to name a street to honor Charlie Kirk's legacy, you don't choose the, I think Equality Utah called it the gayest street in Utah
right.
to be forever called Charlie Kirk Boulevard that is painted rainbow colors and has flags on it 12 months out of the year.
But it does create headlines. There's definitely a lot of conversation that happens around his bills. I don't think most of them pass. They don't gain a lot of traction, but they get a lot of attention, and he gets national attention sometimes for the bills he runs.
Whether this even gets out of the Rules Committee, like, who knows? Like, who knows? We'll see.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're going to preview the legislative session for you. So let me reintroduce our guests. Robert Gerke reports on government and politics for the Salt Lake Tribune. Holly Richardson is the editor of the Utah Policy Newsletter. She writes a column for the Deseret News, and she co-hosts the program Insight Sources on KSL News Radio. And we have Sean Higgins with us. He's a politics reporter for KUER, along with Hugo Ricard Bell. He co-hosts the State Street podcast about local politics. Sean got us started with the one clear theme, if not word, we'll hear a lot of in the coming days, affordability.
The biggest bills are going to deal with affordability in one way or another, whether that's a direct action of money in pockets through some form of a tax cut or a tax credit, or more layers upon layers of regulatory things that could make things like housing cheaper down the road. I just think the way that the economy is feeling for a lot of people right now, the word affordability is going to be heard almost every day up on the Hill.
And I think it's important to remember that this is an election year. And so all of these representatives and half of the senators are going to be going back out to their constituents and saying, I want your vote. And that's where these votes are going to be won or lost, is at those kitchen table issues, right? Is our housing prices too high? Can we afford food? What's our tax rate? And so I think those are the issues they're going to be hitting on prominently. And then the red meat issues that sort of mobilize the base, you know, on things like the culture war issues that you know, will score certain representatives points at the election in the primary, at least in June.
I think the election year issue is an interesting discussion, but not every representative up there is going to have an opponent from within their own party. And I think there's two that don't have an opponent at all, right? And so I think it does change a little bit sometimes how they feel like they have to message. But I think one of the really big overriding issues is what the legislature is going to do about the judiciary and about citizens' initiatives.
So on one hand, what some of you are seeing is the election year is going to define and shape what happens up there. Your sense is lawmakers have been thinking about whether they can wrestle back some of their own power.
Not just thinking about it. I mean, I think they're very clear, and the Republican, both House and Senate majorities, in their priorities, they talk about election integrity, but they talk about basically restoring the balance. And Speaker Mike Schultz has been very clear that he believes that the judiciary has overstepped. And so there's multiple levers that they're going to try to pull this year.
It's interesting when you look at, and let's just sort of explain. So the House Republicans, they all sort of lay out their priorities, the different caucuses up at the legislature to say, and it gives you a sense of what's coming. If you look at the House, which I was, their official policy priorities for this session, you get words like leading with common sense conservative solutions, putting families first, making government more accountable. And you can see these as sort of keywords for we need to deal with this judiciary question, all of those kinds of things. So what do you see when you look at those priorities? Does that just give you a sense of all of that?
It's about time they're putting families first. They've been second for way too long. No, I mean, that's kind of meaningless pablum. But
well, I think to Robert's point about strong families, it's a little bit funny, but it also the Utah birth rate has dropped pretty dramatically recently. I think we're number 10 now for birth rate per capita, right? And we used to be number one for a long, long time. But there's so few details, right? What does that mean, support families? So there's some conversation about, are there any government incentives that would help people decide to have more children? And, you know, it's really hard to find a government program that has actually worked. And a lot of countries have tried it, not just states, right? And what we're finding is those aren't the levers that make the difference. Yes, we need affordable childcare, but a lot of it comes down to personal decision. It comes down to how people are feeling optimistic or not about the future. It comes down sometimes to religiosity. But those are not government functions. And so it'll be interesting to see what they propose to, quote unquote, support families. I know one of the things they want to propose is, again, lowering taxes. But at some point, you've got to fund the government as well.
Yeah.
Well, every year they've been lowering taxes and the birth rate's still falling. So maybe they need to raise taxes. But I do think there are things that government on the margins can do. I mean, like Holly said, I was at a panel this morning with legislative leaders, and they were talking about the need for childcare, because if you can't you know, take care of your kids. You can't work, so you got to choose one. So a lot of people choose work. If you have to have two incomes, two people working full time in the household to make ends meet. So that comes back to the affordability mm-hmm. issue that Sean was talking about. And I think all of these are things where if you're a smart legislator and you have a bill that you want to propose, you're going to try to plug it into one of those buzzwords that they and it creates that synergy that can get your bill passed.
It's another buzzword.
Synergy.
That's a good one. We already sort of discussed about the impact that this being an election year is going to have on the dynamic up there. Let me ask you another kind of, I guess, atmospheric question. Like, what are the leaders – who are the leaders, I guess, on the Hill – not even just leadership, but who are the ones that you that are outspoken, that seem to be driving a kind of agenda that you pay attention to? I'm thinking of people like mm-hmm. like Casey Snyder, majority leader in the House now. What do you make of him, Sean?
I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see his dynamic and how he runs his caucus as majority leader, because he's been working his way up the ranks of Republican leadership over the past few sessions. He's, I believe, an acolyte of Rob Bishop when he was a representative and has come up through with his tutelage there. And Rob Bishop, obviously, a very a successful politician in his own right.
Who might be coming back.
Who might be coming back and working for Casey Snyder.
Yeah.
but I think the read I get on Snyder is the bills he runs are not really red meat bills. He's tasked with a lot of these really complex water rights, land mm-hmm. rights
yeah.
issues.
Yeah.
But when he speaks, it is incredibly forceful and incredibly on message. And I'm thinking of his speaking in favor of a resolution condemning the courts. Like, you were kind of stirred by what he was saying, just by the way he was speaking so forcefully about what Utah has given him and how he felt the actions of the courts were going against every fiber of his being. But
really charismatic.
Yes, I think he's been a very effective person to keep his caucus on message, whatever that message may be. I mean, he was a whip for a while, and I think he was a very effective whip at that one. So I think whether he takes that same approach to managing the entire caucus and maybe having to manage relationships a little bit more than he has in the past, I think that's yet to be seen. But I think he's someone who has quietly wielded a lot of power for a mm-hmm. while, and now he's in a more prominent position.
I agree with that. I'm looking at just the bill list for Casey Snyder. He only has one in progress right now, and it's homeless services land use amendments. But on the homeless issue, I think Representative Tyler Clancy has really been out there the whole time he's been in the legislature.
He's now the coordinator.
He will be after the end of the session, yeah. right? He'll step down after the end of the legislative session. So I think Tyler Clancy is one. If I think about mental health and suicide prevention, I think of Representative Steve Ellison. If I think about higher education, I think about Representative Karen Peterson. So there are certain people who I think are really good at their issues and bringing people along for them.
Yeah, and just to add to that, I totally agree with what Holly's saying. There are people with portfolios who kind of guide those issues. Senator Lincoln Fillmore and Representative Candace Perucci on public ed, K-12 ed, and voucher programs. And so, yeah, everybody's kind of got their little piece that they bring to the table. I'd be curious to know what Holly thinks of this. My impression is that especially in the House, there are these ebbs and flows about how much power and control leadership has over the caucus.
Yeah.
And I get the sense that they have a little bit less control than maybe they did 5 to 10 years ago, that they run things with less of an iron fist than we've seen. Do you disagree?
I do disagree, but I think it's a little more behind the scenes maybe. So it's definitely different than it was when Becky Lockhart was the speaker. Mm-hmm. She was super collaborative. It's still, I mean, just traditionally it has been leadership basically sets the agenda and you fall in line or your bills don't see the light of day.
Yeah.
Is Stuart Adams still one of the most powerful, not just legislative leaders, but political leaders in the state? Is he diminished at all? Is his power? He's been around for a long time. There's some questions about this.
I mean, I think you could make a strong case that he is the most powerful politician in the state, and more so than Governor Cox or Speaker Schultz. And
this is the Senate president.
This is the Senate president. Just because he has so much influence over what comes out of the Senate and shaping the policy in that respect. Now, he's had some negative publicity, obviously, in the last year, and maybe has been tarnished a little bit, but I think he, within his caucus, he still runs the ship. And so I think that means he remains at the helm.
You know, one of the things that's interesting about the Senate, so when I served in the legislature, it's already been 15 years, which is crazy. We always used to joke, and I think it's still the same, that the Senate is where bills go to die, right? Mm-hmm. And part of that is the deliberative process, I think, and part of it is also that Senate leadership can decide what even gets heard or not heard, right? So, yeah, I think Stuart Adams does wield a lot of influence. I'm not sure he's the most powerful legislator or a political figure in the state, but he's certainly up there.
I think I would agree with you guys as well, because just there's fewer personalities to manage in the Senate. And the Senate is sort of stereotypically seen as the more, I don't want to say moderate, but more like...
It's the cooling saucer.
It's the more contemplative body. Schultz is speaking about how he sees the House as more reactionary because they're closest to the people and are up for election every 2 years. Yeah. And they represent a smaller chunk of Utah. And the Senate needs to be a little bit slower because they represent more. But I do think... Stuart Adams, I wouldn't necessarily call him the most powerful, but I think he may be the most powerful man in Utah who is not always in the headlines. Like, you have Governor Cox is in the news all the time. He's in the news nationally all the time. Speaker Schultz is out there quite a bit putting his name to things. Stuart Adams is a little bit more behind the scenes, a little bit more man behind the curtain on a few things, but I think he wields an incredible amount of power.
It's Sean Higgins. He's a politics reporter for KUER, co-host of the podcast State Street. Holly Richardson is a former lawmaker, co-host of the KSL News Radio program Inside Sources. And Robert Gerke, he's a politics reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the 2026 legislative session, which gets underway next week. No major themes for the session are obvious yet, but maybe affordability, because it's clear it will be shaped by an election year. Lawmakers are dealing with a cooling economy, a declining birth rate, what they see as an out-of-control judiciary. There's lots to talk about, and we have with us KUER's Sean Higgins, Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune, and Holly Richardson. Let me ask quickly about the relationship you're anticipating between the executive branch and the legislative branch. The governor, how's he getting along with lawmakers these days? What are the initiatives that he's paying attention to? What are you seeing, at least so far?
I mean, I think what we've seen over the past few years is a very almost deference to the legislature in some ways from the executive branch. I think we saw some pushback last year with a number of vetoes that were really he put his foot down. I'm thinking particularly the bill that changed the way the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court was decided. That has since been amended, and apparently the governor is on board with it now. But I don't see, at least the looking at this list of priorities, the bills that are out there now, even the more controversial ones, there's not really anything that says there will be a big rift between the legislature and the executive branch right now. I think we don't know what will happen as the session moves on. I think back to last session, a lot of the judicial reform stuff took shape second half of the session. We weren't really expecting that to be a big issue a year ago. And then halfway through the session, all of a sudden, we're talking about electing judges and changing the retention process completely. And we might get a curveball like that in 3 weeks. We might not. But right now, I'm not really seeing much that says there will be a soured relationship between Governor Cox and the legislature.
When I looked at his budget last month, there really wasn't much in the way of like big, ambitious, lofty new programs that were going to be things he was going to have to go to the mat for and really fight for.
Literacy.
I mean, I guess there might be a small group of legislators who oppose literacy.
Yeah.
The anti-literate caucus.
I think one of the big things in the budget, you look at $75 million for the homeless campus. Yeah. Like, there are a group of lawmakers, Republican lawmakers, who do think that cities and counties need to step up a lot more. And so they may be a little nervous to put that fund that completely. But as far as like big disagreements, like I think with Robert, like not a whole lot.
I think one of those components, though, with especially the homeless campus, is they were depending on federal funds that are now not coming because of a recent court ruling. And that may really impact how much the legislature is willing to fund. And one of the things to me that's always interesting about the governor's budget is it's kind of like the pirate code for the legislature. They're just suggestions, right? I mean, he may really want this, but they're really just suggestions, and it's the legislature that controls the purse strings. I think one area of tension that could occur is trying to restructure elections in the state of Utah. I don't know how much will be out in the media necessarily, but I know that there's at least some rumblings and some discussions of changing who runs elections in the state of Utah. I think that's a big issue.
Mm-hmm. And then in voter ID is one that the House majority has said that they're focused on. There's some tweaks to signature gathering processes that that they want to look at. There's every year it seems like there's a bunch of elections bills, and I think this year there's probably more than usual.
Yeah, there's several on the signature gathering, and one of the ones I saw I think would change it significantly.
Let's talk about the economy and how lawmakers are thinking about that in the budget. So we've seen some sort of declining revenue forecasts, right? I guess the question is the economy is cooling in Utah. So what does that mean? What do you guys think, just broadly?
Well, it's not just cooling in Utah, right? There's definitely economic uncertainty. And, you know, 2025 ended as kind of just people were really concerned about the economy. And, right, and you go back to, who was it? Was it Bill Clinton? It's the economy, stupid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. James Carville. But
right,
yes.
Right, exactly. So it's one of the issues that people really care about. And so that's your affordability thing that you were talking about at the beginning of the show. I think it's hard for a state in some ways to pull all the levers, right? And so we know that Utah loves to, you know, pat itself on the back for being number one in upward mobility, number one for economic, what is it?
Best managed state.
Best managed state in the nation, right? USA Today ranked them number one for 3 years in a row. But you still have to go down to the family level, I think, and say, okay, well, what does that actually mean? And so, yes, revenues are – I would say they're not continuing to rise at a meteoric rate, but they're still rising. It's just we don't have additional federal funding like we did through the COVID era. I think there are definitely conversations about trying to, quote-unquote, rebalance taxes.
Well, say more about that. One of the things that came up in the House caucus priorities was, again, there's the word again, Sean, affordability, cost of living. Mm-hmm. They talk about rebalancing taxes, property taxes. What's going to happen with property taxes? Do we know?
I think they're looking at any way to take a bite out of the apple with taxes because, I mean, as we were saying, this is an election year. The easiest thing to put on a mailer is voted to cut your taxes for the umpteenth year in a row. Mm-hmm. I think you're looking at like how many years are we looking at income tax reductions now?
It's like five or six in a row.
I've lost count. And I think we're starting to get toward the end of that saga where we can't really do that much anymore. And we're looking at these other levers, property tax. I know it's gotten a lot of traction nationally as an easy target. I think Ron DeSantis in Florida has said they should abolish property taxes altogether. I don't think that's going to happen in Utah, but it is something people are talking about. And I do think one way or another, lawmakers will do something to say they cut taxes again.
The interesting part with property taxes is that's the state legislature cutting local revenues because the state doesn't get any money from property taxes. That goes to your school districts, goes to your counties, it goes to your mosquito abatement districts. They're cutting the revenues for those entities and saying, you guys figure it out. They're not going to take the haircut. There is a bill to cut the income tax again. Senator Dan McKay every year sponsors another one. But this is going to be a hard one because once they've allocated the money, set aside the money for you know, school growth, like enrollment growth, and the other set-asides they have to do. There's basically no money left. So they've told all these state agencies, go, you know, go find 5% in savings, and we'll reallocate that and fund our priorities that way.
Kind of like higher ed last year, right?
Yeah, yeah. And they're doing it statewide. You know, it's an across-the-board thing. The other thing that kind of threw him a curveball is the big, beautiful bill cut about $500 million from the state budget over the two-year period. And so that was an unexpected hit that they had to deal with. And so, look, they always, you know, kind of moan and groan and say, oh, there's no money in the budget because
they, well, didn't they tell state agencies they needed to all trim 5% out of
everybody
their budgets?
Has to come with 5% recommended cuts, and then they'll decide which ones get prioritized, which ones actually get cut. But this is a thing that they've been doing for, I mean, this is going to be my 23rd session up there, I think, and they've done it probably 22 times, you know.
Yeah.
They always want to try to, like, squeeze out efficiencies. They see what, you know, they look at DOGE and kind of say, oh, well, we can do that too. And so, you know, that's part of the kabuki dance that we do up there on the budget side. But it also, I think this year probably is a little bit more relevant just because there really isn't much money to be spent. And if you want to spend $75 million on a homelessness camp,
Where's that going to come from?
Where's that going to come from?
Well, how much revenue could you get from the porn tax?
How much are you watching?
there's a proposal we should mention. I think this is SB 73 that proposes a 7% porn tax. It's supposed to raise, I don't know how much revenue.
We don't have a fiscal note on it yet.
No.
But
is it a serious proposal?
I mean, it's a serious proposal, I guess. I mean, we've already kind of clamped down on all the porn sites in the state
because you thought all left.
You know, so it'll bring some money, and that money's earmarked for a mental health treatment for people
teens
who are impacted by it. And so you know, this bill is one of those that probably will pass just because. Who's going to stand up and oppose it, you know? Mm-hmm. Who's going to go into an election year saying, I stopped the porn tax?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I'm hear something like that, and I'm a little worried of just will that push people into further darker corners of the internet to find what they're after? Because, I mean, porn is not hard to find on the internet.
Right.
Porn you don't have to pay for is not hard to find on the internet. We saw these arguments when Pornhub was banned here that this will force people to go to websites run by Russians or Chinese who could maybe present a security risk for personal security but also national security as well. And I think further pushing people toward unconventional, I guess in air quotes, means of finding what they're after on the internet is something to be careful of when we're talking about these things.
The enforcement mechanism is interesting too. What happens if a company says, no, we're not going to pay that. You know, we're based in the Cayman Islands.
Right. Yeah. What do you do?
There's another interesting proposal to tax advertising on social media sites. So some states, as I understand it, already collect taxes on those. That would be a new source of revenue potentially. I think one of the things, Senator McKay, to what you were just mentioning, Robert, is he's also proposing a rule that says the state will set a top, like, cap on what other taxing entities can actually raise in a year. So that would impact municipalities, school districts, special districts, all of those things. And again, I think that goes back to the argument is that's the state's role of saying, we're going to make sure that you know that we're the boss of you and you have to listen to what we say. Mm. We're going to cut your funding and limit your ability to get more funding.
To get more of it back, yeah.
Let's come back to one of the issues we were talking about a moment ago, and that is the question of reforming the judiciary, which seems to be one of the main issues the session is going to maybe deal with. That is an effort to reform, or as some might put it, punish the judicial branch. Because it falls into that Republican priority list under accountability and transparency, you know, restoring our representative democracy is how they put it. So give me a sense of just like what – Robert, you were mentioning some of the things going – like what are you expecting in the way of change, I guess, in the – in that balance of power, I'll put it that way.
Yeah. I mean the one that the governor seems to – is on board with now is adding two justices to the Utah Supreme Court, going from 5 to 7. He says that this is because Utah's growing as a state. There are senators who say it's because the Supreme Court's not efficient enough. I talked to former Associate Chief Justice John Pierce recently, who just retired from the court, and he said if you're trying to make the court more efficient, adding justices is the completely wrong answer to, you know, it makes it less efficient. And he says the problem is actually further down at the district court level. It's at the Indigent Defense Commission that doesn't get funded the way it should, so it takes a long time to get cases up there. Critics, Senator Stephanie Pitcher, I talked to her about this, and she said it looks like court packing. It's because the Supreme Court's ruled against them. So if they can add two very conservative judges, they're going to get rulings that are more aligned with what they want. But
the governor says, wait, what are you talking about? They're all Republican
appointees,
and we're all Republicans anyway.
Absolutely. But those Republicans have not been aligned enough with the legislature. Hmm. So it's not so much about party. It's more about their ideology and their willingness to support what the legislature does. And if you can add, you know, the governor will have appointed, I believe, 6 of the 7 if they expand it. So and then with Matthew Durant, he's sort of the outlier. He's expected to be leaving before too long. And so it could reshape that Supreme Court. Some of the other things that they're looking at is, you know, adding judges across the state. Senator Wyler has a bill to add 13 judges across the state because that's sort of that lower level that Justice Pierce was talking about. Providing people more information through the performance evaluations is something that they've said they want to do. They want more transparency so people can search cases by judges, you know, to find out how many judges have given somebody probation in a certain instance, things like that, which I think, you know, is certainly plausible. Sean, I'm forgetting a couple. Help me out.
So I there's one, again, this would take an amendment to the Constitution, but how you replace judges when there's a vacancy. And right now there's a judicial nominating commission, and then they sent, I think, 3 names to the governor, and the governor and the lieutenant governor interview those candidates, and then they the governor chooses one from that list. But what this would do is allow him to choose,
forego that.
Yeah, to forego that. He could do that, but he doesn't have to do that. It also would remove a time constraint on the governor to make an appointment, and it also removes the authority of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court to fill a vacancy if the governor failed to fill a vacancy. So that's one that's already written. But another one that I've heard, and this is Speaker Schultz, who suggested that they were open to holding elections for judges. I haven't seen any bill language. I don't know if there will be any, but that was one of the things that he said that he would absolutely consider it still on the table as an option.
And I think one thing you hear constantly in the last couple of years is a lot of these more non-political observers really characterize Utah as one of the gold standards of how we select our judges and retain our judges. And to see efforts to meddle—
Because it's not political?
Yeah. Essentially less political. Obviously, we're being appointed and confirmed by a Republican supermajority, but they are very apolitical in how they are removed almost entirely from the political process unless they are forced to rule on a case. I have to think that if we could live in an alternate universe for 10 minutes where we didn't have redistricting, we didn't have abortion, and there was a bill to expand the Supreme Court by 2 justices, would we be paying that much attention to it? Probably not. You can't separate—
It's defined by those.
Yeah, you can't separate the political moment of now from any efforts to meddle with the courts, whether it's to change the number of judges, change the way they are appointed, or anything like that. It's almost— – I don't think you can separate the two.
We might be paying a little bit of attention to it because there is about a $4.5 million price tag on the expansion of the Supreme Court. There was a bill last session that Representative Jason Kyle had that would require judges who are up for retention to get a supermajority in order to be retained. It didn't pass, but I wouldn't be surprised to see that come back. And Senator Brady Brammers floated the idea of consolidating judicial districts. And the thinking is that he says in rural parts of the state, you have a hard time finding qualified judges willing to serve in the 7th district, for example. But there are those who also point out that, like, well, if you combine Salt Lake and Utah County, you could end up with a lot more conservative judges on the bench drawing from Utah County as opposed to, you know, the liberal bastion of Salt Lake City, where a lot of them are now.
It's Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune. Also with us, Holly Richardson. She co-hosts the KSL News radio program Inside Sources. And we have with us KWR's Sean Higgins. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're previewing this year's legislative session today. Lawmakers are back at it on Tuesday of next week, so we're giving you a sense of what to expect. We have with us Sean Higgins, Robert Gerke, and Holly Richardson.
Let's talk about redistricting and whether this comes up or how it might come up, I guess, in the upcoming session. And we should remind people that lawmakers lost this key battle in court when a judge ruled that the maps that they had drawn were unconstitutional. Lawmakers have now filed a notice of appeal to the state Supreme Court. They're going to challenge it. They've also delayed congressional candidate filing deadlines to March, right, to buy time as the appeal works its way through the courts. So they dealt with some of this during the special session. What's left to do in terms of, like, the redistricting question?
I think as far as, like, laws to change the way the redistricting process works in one way or another, I don't see much. I think a lot of that was addressed during the special session. Just I'm thinking of Senator Brammer's bills that were just really very technical changes about where an appeal will go first to just bypass the district court, go straight to the Supreme Court just to streamline the process.
Does that mean, like, bypass Judge Gibson?
I mean,
next time?
Essentially, yes. Okay, but, like, yeah. Go directly to the Supreme Court if a case is involving elections or redistricting.
Well, I think it's just if there's an appeal, it goes to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court has previously had the option of sending it to the Court of Appeals. Mm-hmm. This just says it stays at the Supreme Court and they have to retain jurisdiction and rule on it. So yeah, because it's just to speed it up.
Redistricting has ping-ponged between the district court and the Supreme Court for the last 2.5 years now, probably. So I think it's just to minimize that back and forth and get to a legal resolution as quickly as possible.
Well, I think there's more to it than that, and I think there's a separation between the ongoing lawsuit, and it's interesting to me that Judge Gibson said basically she didn't understand why they didn't file an appeal in August or then again in November. But as I learned more about the timing for arguments in front of the Supreme Court, it became clear to me that there is no way for this process to resolve before March, before the filing deadline.
And that was their intention?
But I'm going to make a supposition because okay. I don't know for sure. But one of the things that I think will be tried is for legislative attorneys to ask for a stay. And if they had done this process in the fall, the decision probably – they would have exhausted that time frame. But if they ask for a stay while they're still doing these arguments back and forth that are going to take multiple months actually – then potentially they could end up with the same maps from 2024. What I actually think will happen is the Supreme Court will not issue a stay. We'll have new maps in 26, but we'll probably have new maps in 28 and then again in 32, right, at least. And so there's this back and forth. But I also think when you're talking about what can be done in redistricting, they are trying to put another – they will try to put another amendment, constitutional amendment on the ballot. I think basically what it's going to be is saying the Utah legislature has sole authority to do redistricting, period, full stop.
Let's talk about housing. What are we expecting? One of the things Sean, you've talked about is there seems to be kind of a divide among Republicans in the Republican caucus about how much control, you know, local control there is in housing and how that works.
Well, this is to Holly's point about the legislature taking control away from local governments. This is an issue that is not gone away. It's something that the legislature has been focused on for a good number of years now, but it's a little bit different in that you hear the governor say preemption is on the table. And what that means is every city and county basically controls the zoning in their jurisdiction. So South Salt Lake can say you can only build buildings X feet high, this many units, this many parking spaces per unit, XYZ. The state has not had the stomach to come in and make it standardized throughout the state in some form or fashion. The governor has said he's open to that conversation, a little bit of a stick compared to the carrot of past years.
The state taking more control.
The state taking more control, direct control over residential zoning. Yeah. We see legislators like Representative Ray Ward. He's a Republican from the Northern Salt Lake City area who has been really out front on a lot of these housing issues, trying to be really proactive and a little bit more progressive, dare I say, on some of these zoning issues. And my conversations with local leaders and people at the League of Cities and Towns, that makes them incredibly nervous because they would argue that a place like Delta has very, very different zoning needs than South Salt Lake or downtown Salt Lake City and should be treated separately. And no matter of blanket zoning will could actually do more harm than good. So I think that conversation and how that relationship pans out will be actually one of the bigger storylines, I would say. Just talking like when I say they were nervous, like this made them very nervous, people at the local government level and their lobbying groups on the Hill, when they hear the governor talk about taking zoning preemption. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something I'm going to be really focused on as far as what that takes shape as. And we hear the argument supply, supply, supply all the time. And this is an effort to get houses built faster.
More density and all those things. Yeah. What do you think?
One of the bills I'm kind of interested to see if it comes back is one that Representative Clancy had last session that would prohibit corporate ownership of houses, of housing, to try to prevent, you know, big corporations from swooping in and scooping them up. Utah isn't as bad as some areas of the country, but I think there's maybe an appetite to get the Republican legislature doesn't want to control the free market, right? But at the same time, there might be an appetite to at least try to keep these corporations from cornering the market like they've done in places like Atlanta.
Didn't Donald Trump give them an opening?
I think this is another thing where national politics could be covering it. Because I remember talking with Representative Clancy last session. He got a lot of pushback on this bill, and it really didn't get off the ground. Mm-hmm. But then we have national figures come in and say, hey, hedge fund managers shouldn't own houses and then rent them back to people. Like that's the biggest opening they could hope for if you are in favor of not having private equity buying up houses.
I think it does give them a little bit of permission. I haven't talked to Representative Clancy, so I don't know if it's coming back this session or not. There was a Democrat who was sponsoring a similar bill, so you know we could have that discussion.
I think it's interesting, too, that it's something that is really important, I think, to members of the public as well as legislators, and we just can't seem to solve the problem, right? We're super expensive. Starter homes are averaging $600,000 now in Utah, right? And when we talk about we want our kids to be able to grow up here, also to raise their families here, they can't move into a starter home that's $600,000, right? And so we have this impasse where it feels like, for example, during the municipal election last year, I would say a number of mayors lost their races partially because they were pro-development and the people in their communities were like, not in our backyard. And yet they still also want their kids to be able to have affordable housing. They just don't want it there.
Well, and I've heard from some mayors and local officials that they don't mind the legislature coming in and taking some of that
authority. Because then they get the blame.
Because then they can say, well, we tried. You know, we didn't do it. It was them. So,
all right, let's I want to come back briefly to talk about another one of those priorities for House Republicans, which was about strengthening families. What seems like what they're doing is they're sort of framing like family formation, especially child raising and fertility, as kind of a policy challenge for the state. So what are you expecting? Are you seeing any bills? Like what can you even do about that? And is this just sort of a statement as a priority? Because I'm not sure what you could do policy-wise beyond that.
There are policies, and some of them are taxes, right? So expanding the child tax credit. I think we're going to see multiple bills addressing child care. Senator Heidi Baldry is running a bill that would give additional tax credit for businesses that provide on-site childcare. I mean, there's just a variety of ways that people are trying to approach this. What I don't think will work is somehow saying there's some kind of dollar incentive for you to have a baby and stay home. And anything I think that comes across as women belong in the home with their kids and shouldn't be at work, I don't think that's going to be really well received by a lot of people in the public. Because the reality is, even though we might love to say the best policy is to have a parent in the home raising the baby, we have something like 85% of mothers with children at home are in the workforce.
I do think a lot of the more family-centered messaging is going to be one way or another related to childcare. I'm a new dad. This is something I'm acutely aware
You're thinking
of.
About this a lot.
I did a story on this recently where I think there's only enough licensed childcare centers to serve 36% of Utah yeah. families where their parents are in the workforce. Write bills that make it easier to start a childcare service. And I think we had some bills last year that would have repurposed some old state buildings mm-hmm. to turn it into childcare. Those failed on the floor. Expanding child tax credit. I know Senator Luz Escamilla, who's the minority leader in the Senate, has been very, very out front on this issue. And I know she will definitely have bills on this year. So I think when we talk about becoming a more family-friendly state, like Holly was saying, it's going to be childcare adjacent for the vast majority of this stuff.
Yeah.
We can't leave before talking a little bit about water, which leads to sort of indirectly a conversation about the lake. So what do you expect? Republican priorities include tackling aging infrastructure and insufficient supply, but they say water's a priority for them. Is that manifesting in legislation? The executive director of the Department of Natural Resources said that this year was going to be a watershed year. So what are you seeing for water and attention to the lake?
Right now, a lot of talk. not so much legislation we can really point to. I mean, we had the year of water, air quotes, the year of water. What was that, 3-4 sessions mm-hmm. ago? Mm-hmm. And a lot of those changes were supposed to be phased in over the next 5, 10, however many years. So we're kind of reaching the end of that horizon right now. Maybe we're reassessing some of those changes, big changes that were made, and making tweaks to that. So I think, obviously, with the Olympics coming 10 or was it 8 years from now? Mm-hmm. Wow, we're already in 2026.
Yeah.
There's going to be renewed focus because that has been a national story that is kind of a black eye on the face of Utah is the Great Salt Lake and how it is drying up and we have toxic dust and we have inversion right now mm-hmm. and just all of these environmental factors. And I think there are serious economic incentives to keep water in the lake, but there's also just PR incentives as well.
Yeah,
I think one of the issues is what comes down from the sky, right? This year has not been particularly friendly. So I don't like you. I'm not seeing a lot of actual bills, but it's early days. We only have about 350 bills drafted. I'm expecting another 900.
At least. I was talking to Natural Resources Director Joel Ferry last week, and one of the things that I think is hanging over this is they're in negotiations right now for the Colorado River Compact. Mm-hmm. And so there are questions about how much water we're going to be getting out of that river, and that's a big deal. They've got a deadline for February 14th, which happens to hit fairly smack dab in the middle of the legislative session, that the feds want them to come up with an agreement, and probably won't happen. One of the things he said he wants is he wants Utah to get credit for its conservation. Yeah. And I think if they can get some credit toward its river allocation, if they do more conservation, that gives them an incentive to do more conservation. But I think they're kind of waiting to see how that shakes out. And so in terms of like big sweeping changes, I'm not anticipating very much. Now, the aging infrastructure is a real thing, and yeah. It's something that they've tried to put money into, reservoirs, pipelines, et cetera, so you can get more efficiency that way. If there is money available, again, we talked about the tight budget year. If there's money available, I would anticipate that some will go there. But that's not going to solve the problem.
So we're on track. How do you think for like 900 more bills? Do you want to say something finally about this move from Representative Orkelin to run a bill that would limit the number of bills you can run?
Yeah. So one of the issues, of course, that we know is it feels like every session, the number of bills introduced or even proposed just grows and grows and grows. And so what Representative Orkelin wants to do is just make a limit. I don't know how much support it has outside of people who are already not in the legislature, right? Because it's really interesting. So you look across the board and some legislators are really, really active at proposing a number of bills. But you also look at leadership. They propose almost no bills, but they certainly have an impact on what bills are discussed and what's being run. I think the problem that Representative Orkelin has identified is that the vast majority of the bills pass the last week of the session. And by the time you get there, you're suspending the rules. You're limiting debate to 30 seconds. I mean,
you're covering up the clock.
Right. I mean, it's just like those types of things happen. And so I do think it's a fair argument to say the bills at the end of the session don't get the same type of attention as bills earlier in the session.
It's Holly Richardson. She's the editor of the Utah Policy Newsletter. She co-hosts the KSL News radio program Inside Sources. Robert Gerke is a politics reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. And Sean Higgins, he is KUER's politics reporter, the co-host of the podcast State Street, which just launched its newest season. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on YouTube at KUER90.1 and Instagram at Radio West. You can email us at radiowest@KUER.org. Aidan Oneida is our social media intern, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.